This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today marks the 49th anniversary of Earth Day, the day founded by Wisconsin's Gaylord Nelson to focus attention on environmental affairs. Lake Effect's Susan Benz has several stories that she's planning this week on one particular corner of environmentalism, plus an interview that we'll hear in a few minutes.
Susan is with us in the studio to share a preview of everything she's working on this week, and you have lined up a full-on series, correct?
That's right, Mitch. The Earth Day movement that started in 1970 sparked not only increased awareness but action. That included the creation of the EPA, the passage of the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts. But keeping our environment in balance is not an easy feat. So we've decided to focus this week on one element of the challenge, that's waste and largely stuff that we create.
And we create a lot of waste.
We do.
I sense there is a recycling story on the horizon then?
Definitely. In 1989, Wisconsin passed what is considered a ban, or is a ban, that keeps certain items out of landfills. That gradually led to recycling programs around the state. And today, businesses built around that sorting and baling are struggling, especially because China stopped importing U.S. materials.
Now, they were importing this recycled stuff in order to turn it into new stuff?
New stuff, yes. But that break in the partnership caused a huge disruption in the supply-demand change. That's the topic we explored earlier today during Morning Edition.
So let's look ahead to later in the week. You're moving on to other forms of waste, such as food, right?
That's right. We talked with a group that hopes to encourage not only efficient composting of food waste, but they're testing how it will break down when they add other compostables like cups to the mix.
We've seen these like compostable cups that you get
right.
at certain coffee shops and restaurants.
They want to know that if they can get larger operations going of composting, that will all break down and it'll create good stuff.
Cool.
They were also talking to a handful of volunteers, or one of those handful of volunteers, that came up with an idea less than a year ago, and it's gaining traction in Milwaukee. They're calling themselves Plastic Free Milwaukee.
Okay.
And there's more, Mitch, including a junk hauling business based in Butler that's evolving into much more than that.
And you went to the ballpark for some reason.
Well, I wish I had, but I got a phone conversation with Brent Suter. He's a Milwaukee Brewer pitcher, as you know. But you may not know that he's advocating climate change action among his teammates, starting with the kind of water bottles they use.
A virtual trip to the ballpark.
Yeah, I wish I'd been there.
Well, so then let's flash forward to today on Lake Effect, because you're bringing us a conversation with someone who is widely recognized as a leader in the environmental movement and in political activism. Tell us a little bit about Winona LaDuke.
Winona LaDuke's home base is White Earth Reservation in northwestern Minnesota, but she travels really not just the country, the globe. She has strong opinions and a lot of knowledge around climate change, renewable energy, and environmental justice. So she was in Milwaukee a couple of weeks ago meeting with students, and she gave a public lecture at UWM, so I met her there on campus. And she began with her straightforward take on why climate action is imperative.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what planet you're all from, but I'm from this one. And this is the only place, you know, they aren't making any new water. What we got is what we're going to have. Same water as dinosaurs, so might as well take care of what we got. They aren't going to make any new air. And to the last time I acknowledged, I don't believe that a corporation owns the air, but they act as if they do. They pump it full of toxins. You know, we live in a society of America that is based on pretty much the idea that you could just keep moving on, there's going to be someplace else to go, and you pretty much run out of stuff. At the same time, a couple things. One is that all of our ancestors used to navigate by the stars. Now most people won't go outside without a GPS. A lot of people are pretty confused as to who they are. I know Native people are less confused because we still retain our land, our water, our identity. I am sure that there's this moment in time that we're all in now where you got a choice. It's called the seventh fire, the time of the seventh fire, when we're told we have a choice between two paths. One is well-worn, but it's scorched. The other is not well-worn, and it's green. And we have to choose upon which path to embark. I think that that's all of our situation. You know, if you want to be able to feed yourselves, if you want to be able to have some kind of energy, if you want to have some kind of water in the future, you better take some stands now. And, you know, as you look out there with a climate change that is upon us, the reality is that, you know, Americans live by and large in this like box. You know, most people don't even look a lot larger than their computer screen or their phone screen. They live inside a box. They go from a climate-controlled room or house to a climate-controlled car and SUV around and pretend like it's all going to work out. That's a pretty artificial world. Your ancestors spent most of their time outside, not inside in a mega mansion that requires a lot of fossil fuels. In that, I think we had your ancestors and my ancestors had a lot more humility. The arrogance of industrial society, the arrogance of America is not sustainable. Because in the end, we all live in this mother on this Mother Earth. And in the end, you could be the, you know, have all the models you want, but when that bomb cyclone of some snowstorm takes out your town, you know, Mother Nature had the last word. She's gonna have the last word. You know? She's gonna take down stuff that don't make sense. So
you've dedicated your life to you know, living what the way that you were raised. You said you came from good people. You're a very bright woman, and you went to Harvard. What did your dad say to you at that time that was sort of a key moment?
My father, who was quite an accomplished man, I mean, he did go to school to the eighth grade, subsequently wrote a bunch of books and was an actor in Hollywood. He came to see me and he said, I don't want to hear your philosophy if you can't grow corn. And so I've been a corn grower for a long time now. And some of it just coming out of that, but also over time, I've learned that plants teach you a lot. You know, so I grow corn, beans, squash, heritage potatoes, Jerusalem artichokes, tobacco, and hemp. You know, that's what I grow at kind of a larger scale. I grow a lot of basil and tomatoes and vegetables for home gardens. But plants teach you. And you can act as if you're smarter, but plants are smart. Plants are very smart. And it will adapt. A plant will adapt. Like our wild rice coming back after 50 years. You know, that's pretty resilient. And if you treat your plants right, they will teach you a lot. You know, growing hemp has been really interesting to me. I'm a state licensed hemp farmer by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I've been growing for 3 years in their state pilot project. My interest is in fiber hemp primarily, although I'm interested in the whole plant. There's a lot of interest, of course, in CBDs and cannabis and marijuana. I think that that's all really interesting too. And I'm a supporter of the legalization of cannabis, and I am a supporter, and I do grow CBD rich varieties, medicinal varieties of, but I can't grow anything with THC in it in order to keep my state permit.
What's the potential you see in the fiber aspects of?
Well, in hemp fiber is, you know, until about the 1920s, about 80% of Minnesota had a lot of clothing from hemp. Minnesota had 11 hemp mills. We grew all our own clothing and rope between linen and hemp. The word canvas comes from cannabis. So if you just want to talk about the potential, there you go. And the fact is that fossil fuels now control our clothing. Everything that we're wearing is basically made of fossil fuels, and it's all toxic between the production of it, the, you know, processing of it, and also the washing of it and the loss of it. Microfibers in all of our ecosystems because of washing of polyesters and synthetics. So I'm interested in rebuilding a textile economy in this country. Minnesota used to have 11 hemp mills, as I said, until the 1940s when hemp was demonized along with marijuana. And so we are behind every other country in the world that has been growing hemp continuously. We also, in this country, made a set of decisions to offshore our entire textile industry. And so the Carolinas, New England, nobody produces textiles anymore. And so everything we produce comes from China or India. And I believe that good American textiles or North American textiles are what we want.
So is part of the story that you'll be sharing or the perspectives you'll share with the audience this evening in Milwaukee, looking at the, you know, what's out there for us to learn about renewable energy and sustainable food systems? And
well, you know, the United States, 1% of our trains are electrified. Well, about 60% of them are electrified in Italy. Why would you want to have a train system that's like in a first world country that's this is a train system that would be an embarrassment to Bulgaria. What if you built infrastructure that made sense? What if you built a grid system that was based maybe on your trains at something called solutionary rail? I'm going to talk about that tonight, which can transport distributive energy. You can pick it up along the rail lines and use those corridors as a way to move energy. What if you didn't want to live in a situation where you drove everywhere in a combustion engine vehicle that is 16% efficient? When you can have an electric engine that's 65% efficient, why would you want to continue with an inefficient vehicle when you could move to something that's efficient? Why would you want to import water from Fiji when you could have water in Wisconsin? Why would you want to, you know, have a carbon footprint on everything that you consume 1,400 miles from farmer to table? Let me know how that's going to work out in climate change. Let me know how that's going to work out in climate change. Wisconsin could produce all its own food. You know, Wisconsin produced all its own food when we lived here. You know, no absence of the ability to restore a local food economy, a local food and agriculture. I mean, I lived through the dairy termination program. I lived on a farm during the dairy termination program. You know, and I know that Wisconsin and Minnesota were laid to waste. And if you drive in northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin, there are a lot of farms with no animals on them. You know, I think that dairy termination program and the centralization of dairy to the Central Valley in California was ecologically and socially and a wrong thing to do. You know, I'd like to see the return of local agriculture. You know, so it's not really just like a native thing. It's like, what if we started making decisions that made sense? What if we rebuilt local economies? What if we made canvas and rope in Wisconsin and Minnesota? Because we could.
So it makes me think of one of the things you mentioned when you were talking with a group of students, which is, you know, there's a difference between being smart, being, you know, educated, having a degree, and knowing how to do stuff, how to take care of.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I have a liberal arts education and a master's degree, and, you know, I'm pretty smart. You know, my father told me to grow corn. I mean, we are raising people who are really smart, super critical. I've noticed that across the board. I've got a few of them in my own family, but actually don't do anything. That's to say they don't know how to fix their car. They don't know how to fix their clothes. They don't know how to grow their food. They don't know how to heat their house. They don't know how to fix their house. They don't know how to do a lot. Now, it's not to say that you could do all those things. You know, you probably don't want me hunting too much, you know, but I could fish with a net. I could process food. I can grow food. I feel good about that. You can, you know, I just feel like the presumption is, they say that the average North American lives in a house with the equivalent of like 100 slaves. Think about that. Where's your energy come from? Not here. You didn't put any effort into it, did you? You just flipped the switch, paid for it. You know, at some rate set by somebody based on some set of figures, you know? I mean, so I'm interested in these questions really of how we're going to not just survive, because, you know, I mean, indigenous people have already lived through the post-apocalypse economy. We are it. You know, we understand what post-apocalyptic looks like. How about if we try to avoid that again? You know, and how about we try to make some coherent decisions that ensure that we still got water, we've got local food, and as climate change comes upon us because a bunch of bad decisions were made, we actually have a shot at not just surviving through it, but living with some quality of life. That's me. I'm all for it, you know.
When you go and talk to a group, when you spend time with people, is there one element you want most to resonate or hope resonates with people?
What do you hope this can do?
You know, I think at the center is the question of agency. You know, I mean, we're super privileged North Americans. We're super privileged. We're like the T-Rexes of the world. And so what if you, in your position of privilege, use that agency to do things to make the world better? You know, we got agency. We got a shot. You know, the stories I tell are the stories of a community that nobody would thought we had a shot. You know, we got a shot and we took it and we're still taking it because no one's going to fix stuff for us. You know, so if you're waiting for someone to fix something for you, you're going to be disappointed and you're not going to like how they fix it for you. Best do it yourself. Best do it yourself.
Political and environmental activist Winona LaDuke is based on the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. She was also a two-time vice presidential candidate on the Green Party ticket. She spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz, and you can find more of Susan's Earth Week coverage at WUWM.com.